It was a buffet and comedy show. Oh. Now, for like now, with, in hindsight, we should have known instantly this was not going to work out. But I mean, there were more problems then. So it was a buffet and comedy show, and the problem was the buffet was a really, really good deal.
Oh.
So the audience was not there for comedy. They were strictly there for the buffet. And so they didn't get, by the way, language on this. They didn't, I'll say, they didn't give a crap.
No, you can okay. say.
Well, they didn't give a crap about the comedy at all. And so, and of course, it's a buffet. So the entire show, you're like, hey, Alberta, how's it going? Nothing, because everyone's going for like, oh, the shrimp came out. Okay, back up. It's a good line for shrimp. That show, at no point during that 1 hour show, did anyone hear a word of what we said? Like, not one. Not one. Like, yeah, so you learn. You learn. But that's the other bad show. Like, Ben, this is going to happen to you, too, because you're an entertainer. Did you ever get, like, rented out as a prize at a raffle where you get a comedian to come to your house for, like, to do a private show? So you get a comedian to come to your house for a private show. Again, this was early days. I think just... the idea sounded fine. Nobody really thought it through. Because, like, just showing up at someone's house, there's no microphone, there's no lights. There's nothing. So I went, it was a barbecue in, like, I forgot.
Something. I've had things like this.
Yeah. Well, you know, for comedy, like, you need certain things. You don't need a lot for comedy.
No.
You need a microphone.
Yeah.
Or something to focus attention on you.
Yeah.
So what happened was I showed up at this barbecue, and it was near sunset. So they're like, you have to quickly perform because it's getting dark and we're up to see you.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, where do you guys want me? And they're like, oh, well, I guess maybe in front of the grill. So I'm they're still cooking. Like, they had their helper cooking on the grill.
Yeah.
And I'm like, so I'm trying to tell jokes in front of the grill. And there's like, you know, you hear the tsss, like burgers behind me. And then I also didn't realize that there'd be children at this party. And another thing about comedians, like stand-up comedy, you gotta be told that there's gonna be children.
Yes.
You know, like
yeah.
that there's the young children because
your whole act has been in the evening for adults.
Yes, and I didn't have a particularly dirty act.
No,
but still, like there's language, and a lot of times, you know, with comedy, you don't. Remember that you have a certain part of punch, like a
really
punchline.
A really important part of the punchline might be a swear word.
Yes, and there was one, and I'm like, oh, no, I can't do this. Like midway through, and then I just remember like the kids were there, like running, like literally running circles around me while I'm performing. One kid threw a bottle at me. Like, I don't not on purpose. I think he was just throwing it. He was like four. He's just throwing it, like hit me. Another, like we were on a concrete patio. This kid grabbed one of those like old wrought iron chairs and just. Midway, I never wanted to leave a set more than that one.
Hello, this is Meet the Entertainers, and I am Big Ben. If you are a juggler, a unicyclist, if you are a magician, a face painter, a stand-up comedian, this is the podcast for you. Every week I interview entertainers from all around the world. Today, I'm talking to a stand-up comedian, but let's get him to introduce himself. Take it away, Ryan.
My name is Ryan Hynek. I am a high school English teacher and stand-up comedian. I was born in Palatine, Illinois, USA, back in 1976.
Wow.
I'm getting old.
That's me.
Yeah. And, but I mean, today we're talking mostly about comedy, so, you know, my teaching career isn't that interesting, but my comedy career has always been kind of something I like to talk about. A lot of people, I think, who do comedy are like, I never had any desire to do this. I've always wanted to. Like, I don't want to be a professional comedian, but I have always, always wanted to do comedy.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, and I, like, really, like, there's, I remember... there was a bar in my hometown, a small town.
Jester's Lounge.
Yeah, did I talk to you about this before?
No, I've done a little bit of research.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah. That's true. That's a true story. So this bar, as a kid, I saw this, and I assumed that it was a comedy club. Because, you know, your whole world is your town, right? And so I knew there were comedy clubs in the world. I thought it was a comedy club. And I remember, like, just we'd drive by it all the time on my way to Showbiz Pizza. That's a kid's, I don't know if you guys know where that is, but it's a children's play area. I was like, oh, one day I'm going to be on that stage at Jester's Lounge. You know, it's just that was what, like, kept the flame alive. And then, I turned 21, and I'm like, guys, we're going Jester's Lounge. I got to see this place. I got to see how the comedy is. I'm 21 years old. Yeah. I should have known by this time.
How old were you when you first saw this place?
When I first saw it, I was probably 5.
Really?
Yeah, because,
that long?
Yeah, oh, no, honestly, it's like 16 years of my life is built up as, like, this is, like, and the funny thing is, like, yeah, by the time I was 21, I should have recognized, A, that it was not a comedy bar, and B, like, that there are actual real comedy bars outside of my tiny little town. So anyway, I went there, 21 years old, walked into the doors expecting to see, like, a stage and, like, a show, and it was just the crappiest towny bar. Like, Ben, it was this. I don't know if this fills the picture for you. It was a carpeted bar. Like, that's how, like, I don't know, that for some reason that just made it worse. It was the worst. It was like hanging out in somebody's basement and having a Pabst Blue Ribbon. It was the worst. It was such a letdown.
So how come you were interested in comedy at such an early age? Did you have brothers and sisters or family members who were interested in something similar?
You know, so I have two. I'm the youngest of three. And brothers. And my dad is always, like, joking around. He's a pretty funny guy. I don't know. I was always the funny one in my family, I think. I was definitely the funny one in my classes at school.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't a class clown.
Right.
You know, there is a difference, yeah. Right? There is the kid who tells jokes, and then there's the class clown, who's
right.
just usually kind of silly, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, in high school, I tried a little stand-up for the talent show. You know,
yeah.
That was my first time really trying that. And I, you know, that's where I first learned about how good it feels to do well.
Yeah.
And how good it feels to bomb. Because it was a two-night show.
Oh.
First night I did it, killed, you know, in front of high school kids. Second night I did it, bombed. You know. And it's just amazing to get all that on the very first go, you know?
Yeah.
Do I continue to talk about this? Yeah. Getting started with comedy itself.
Yeah. So you're interested as a kid.
Yeah.
You like telling jokes at school. You are a guy who tells jokes at school.
Yeah.
You go on stage at school in the talent show.
Yep.
Stand-up comedy.
Goes well and badly. That worked out. And then nothing for, well, like in college, like I was like a host of a TV talk show and all that stuff.
Host
and
of a TV talk show? What is that?
For university. It was a show called The Show With No Name. It was like a late night style talk show. So I was the host of that. And so the one thing that I added to that show, it was a show that was a long running show in our university, but the one thing I added to it was a monologue before, just like so I would do monologues. But the problem is, you do these monologues with there's no audience because it's a campus TV show, just the camera guy.
Just like The Tonight Show or Letterman.
Yeah, but with no audience, with zero audience. So I'm telling these jokes to no one. I thought they were funny, but I watch those tapes now and it's so cringy because, you know, whenever you see yourself.
You still got the tapes?
Yeah, I do. I do have some of those tapes.
Anything on YouTube yet? Or is it
you know what? I have some digital versions of that. I should put it on.
Was it your main hobby? Because when I was a kid, I was interested in all kinds of things.
Mm.
And being on stage was just one of them.
Yeah, it was just one of my hobbies. And it wasn't like a real, you know, there was never, nothing came to fruition until high school when I got to sort of do it on stage.
Yeah.
You know? But then here in Hong Kong, there was a bar in a place called Wan Chai.
Are you big down under?
Yes. Oh, wow. Yeah, you did. Where is all this written?
I did a little bit of research online.
I do remember writing this somewhere, but I don't remember where.
What was the bar called, Ryan?
It was called the Kangaroo Down Under.
Okay.
Yeah. It was an Australian bar. And they had, like, an open mic competition. And I realized I should not hit this table.
It's okay. Don't worry about it.
Open mic competition. And I brought a bunch of my friends. And I won the first round of this because it really nobody was doing stand up. Everybody was just telling knock knock jokes from books. I was the only one who took it seriously and wrote.
So let me just ask you, when was this? You're from America.
Yeah.
From not from Palestine.
Not from Palestine.
From Palatine. Mm-hmm. So when did you come to Hong Kong, and why did you come here?
Oh, I came here in 2000. I used to be a journalist in the U.S.
Ah.
Did not like that job.
Right.
Came here to try teaching.
Okay.
And it really, I liked it.
Yeah.
I like teaching here. Yeah. I've been doing that at the same school since 2000.
Wow.
Yeah. It really, like, before comedy, that was what kind of filled that's kind of scratched that itch.
Yeah.
Because I got my students to perform in front of. So
yeah,
I used to. I mean, I used to probably joke around a lot more with them than I do now.
No, teaching makes sense. I did teaching for a while. You are in front of a crowd.
Yep. And I'll tell you this. I tried to make, and I still try to make my lessons this way. I try to make my lessons sort of like a show.
Yeah.
I like my lessons to have, you know, like in comedy, like that good first laugh. What in my lessons, I try to make that really good first big impression of the lesson,
yeah,
then kind of the meat, and then close with something big again, yeah, whether it's a game or something else. But my lessons kind of model my stand-up in a way.
Sign autographs.
And sign autographs. Well, just as many autographs.
You know, they sell DVDs, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just as many as I do for my comedy. So, yeah, same number. Zero. Yeah, I did that, so I've been doing that in the 20 years of that.
Okay, so great. That's why you're in Hong Kong.
Yeah, that's the full-time job.
If you see that this Down Under bar in Wan Chai,
yeah,
has a talent show, was it?
It was an open mic.
Open mic.
Yeah, competition.
It has an open mic competition.
Yeah.
So where did all this material come from for that first go?
So, yeah, you know what, that's right. Now as you're asking me, I was ready to do stand-up. I wanted to do it.
Yeah.
But I've written a lot of monologues, so that's where a lot.
Yeah.
That's where a lot of the stuff. But no. But I had been working on my first, my first 10 minutes for a long, long time. Like I'd stuff circulating for a long time. I used to write jokes. I just had nowhere to tell them.
So perfect.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, it wasn't a fluke that I started doing this. I really wanted to do it.
Yeah.
But I don't really want to do it as a profession at all.
Well, you don't think you can in Hong Kong do it full time. Someone like Vivek works pretty much half his money comes from some sort of emceeing or talking or comedy. The other half comes from other things like computers and jobs.
That's right. Yeah, I'm not sure that there is enough of a market here for it, especially in English.
Oh, that was me, by the way, doing insider stuff. Vivek Nabubani.
Oh, yeah.
He was one of the first big finds at the Takeout Comedy Club in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
And I've got a podcast from him somewhere, so you can
check it. I remember seeing a link to that, yeah.
Check the archives, yes.
He's a powerhouse here in Hong Kong.
Yeah. He's done very well. But even him can't go full time because it's just not a big enough market.
That is very true. Although, yeah.
And he can speak both languages, Cantonese and English. Yes. And even he can't do it full time.
That's why it makes it so hard for any of us to get any gigs.
Yeah.
Vivek. Because he's so good. And he speaks both languages.
Okay. So you get through you do well in the first round, you said?
Won the first round. Didn't win the second round. Because the second... I mean, like... It wasn't a real competition.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it out of spite. I'm saying it was like, it was just a bunch of, it was everybody goofing off.
Yeah.
So they gave it to like an old man who went up and just told knock-knock jokes that he read directly from a book.
Right.
He won. It's fine. There was no bitterness because it was clear like, this is hilariously adorable that this old man is reading these from a book.
Yeah. So
But then, from that show, one of my friends said, hey, I've heard about this club opening up in Soho called, like, it's like a takeout something show.
Oh.
And then, like, then I went to go watch, and I saw you and Chris and Chris Coleman, who's also one of the stand-up comedians. What were some of the other big names back?
Chris Musney.
I remember.
Tom Schmidt.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I run into Tom every once in a while. Tom Schmidt is a really great comedian who's got some amazing voice talent.
Yeah.
Oh.
He was the first one of that first group of us who actually seemed like you...
Polished,
yes.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. No, that was pretty obvious. So the one thing, Ben, and I hope this doesn't come across as an insult, but...
No, go for it. I love being insulted.
But the fact that everyone that I saw that night was so new.
Yeah.
Let's just say new. New's a good word. Yeah. I think we know what new means.
We were new.
Yeah.
Yes. We were definitely new.
Yes, yes. Very new.
Apart from Tom Schmidt.
Yeah, apart from Tom Schmidt. So, it, like, from my perspective, I'm like, oh, I can probably do that.
Yeah.
You know, that's something I can do. If I'd come to shows now that are much more polished with,
yes,
like, people who've been doing it a lot longer,
yeah,
I don't think I'd have the courage to try it.
No, it's a perfect opportunity
it
for
was.
Me as well.
Yeah.
I mean, was this 2007?
I think that might, yeah, it must have been the time.
Yeah, it must have been, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so thank you for not being, you know, polished at that point. Otherwise,
what I did in order to encourage you is, yeah, I remained rubbish for the following 10 years. So, you know.
That is not true.
So, Jamie Gong opened the Take Out Comedy Club in 2007, as he called it, and I think true, the first full-time comedy club in Asia, as far as
you can't argue with that. Yeah, that's true.
The first full-time comedy club, and he's starting from a basis of having no comedians.
Yep.
So if you were willing to go to his workshop, or even just go to have 10 minutes on stage, you do it. He put you on stage in those early months.
Yeah, early months. I mean, a lot of us got up there. We're doing shows that we weren't quite ready for, but because you had to, it was sink or swim, and it worked out in the end. I do have to, like, without getting too far off track, give Jamie a lot of credit for that.
Yes.
Because that's daunting. You know?
I know.
Putting your entire business on that with no...
To move from New York,
yeah,
to come to Hong Kong,
yeah,
and decide you're going to set up a comedy club in,
right,
a place where there is no comedy,
yeah,
club, where there are no
There's
comedians.
No comedians. How did you find him?
Well, like I said earlier... maybe before the interview, I lived opposite the,
yeah,
comedy club.
Oh, okay,
and
fair. Yeah,
I had maybe the local paper. What is it? The Hong Kong.
Oh, HK Mag or something like that.
I just flipped through it and it said, comedy workshop, Wednesday, 5 p.m. Was it my club? It was Wednesday.
Yeah.
It's 4:55.
No.
Okay, run down.
Like literally that.
Run down. Go down that. Yeah, literally.
Oh.
That was it.
And that changed it.
And that changed the course of my life for the next 10 years.
Honestly, right, right.
Right place, right time.
That's exactly it. I mean, in a way it was the same for me, not as, it wasn't 5 minutes,
yeah,
window there, but same thing, like right place, right time. Again, if I came into the scene right now, brand new, I don't think I would,
yeah,
do it. I don't think I'd have the guts to get up there now.
So how did you, what did you do for your first set at Take Out Comedy?
Oh, I do remember,
it the same sort of stuff that you'd done, must have been the same sort of stuff you'd done at the Down Under competition?
Yeah, I'm guessing it was. I did find recordings of that online. Yeah, it was jokes about my family, about my mom, you know, and like how clean she was.
Yeah.
And like, I remember a joke about towels. Do you remember that? I used to tell a joke about, like, there's the towels that you only come out for guests.
You know, like, yes.
You know, and as a kid, we were never allowed to touch those. Yeah, I used to tell a lot more stuff about my family because that's where the comedy came from.
Yeah, yeah. Came from your family.
Came from my family. I mean,
that was the material.
You think about your life experiences at that age. I was pretty young, 30. Something. But I mean, your life experience at that point, it's like most of it revolves around growing up in your,
yeah,
family's house.
Yeah.
That's where the majority of your time is.
And what was the experience like those first few months doing it?
Oh my gosh. You know what? The first few months, actually, I remember being really good.
Yeah.
Because, like you were saying, it was lots of family and friends were coming.
Yeah.
I would say by the end of the year, I don't remember this exactly, but I'm assuming, because I do, as you do as well, I remember the very difficult times,
yes,
we had, early days. And I think those were after the kind of honeymoon period.
After the soft launch, the honeymoon period.
Yeah, like after our friends had all seen us,
yeah,
and were not going to come see us again.
Yeah.
Doing shows for, gosh, I mean, we did a show for one person.
There were some times, some of us know, and really,
yeah,
there's no one in millions.
I think, in all fairness, I can only remember canceling one show in all those years,
yeah,
because no audience came.
Yeah.
But you know, it's amazing to think that it only happened once, I think only once, because we definitely did shows quite regularly for audiences of five.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
Tell me about the first comedy competition. So that would be at the end of 2007. Did you enter the first?
I did. Well, it's the Jamie Gong, the manager of the club, told me I should join because there weren't really a lot of comedians.
Yeah.
And I did, but man, I was so nervous.
It was packed. I remember that night. It was like the whole wall to wall crammed in.
Yep. That would have been my first big show.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a good show. I have that on tape. I was watching that recently, and just watching some of those guys back then. Like Nick Milnes. I remember watching Nick back then. Nick Milnes is another comedian that we work with.
I've interviewed him as well.
Oh, have you? Okay, yeah. And just, thinking, it's just so funny because now Nick's my buddy. But like back then being like, oh, he's like larger than life comedian. Yeah.
So, yeah. I can remember I made a mistake for the first ever competition.
Yeah.
I thought, well, I've done the same set since April.
Right.
I should probably do a different set.
Oh, no.
So what I did, so a brand new set for the first ever competition, which totally died.
God,
And that set the tone for me. And then I thought, okay, I'm never going to change my set again. Like the same thing.
10 years down the road, lesson learned.
That was a beginner's mistake.
That is a very, very, I think, common beginner's mistake.
Yeah.
I remember the following year, Jamie told me I should enter again, and I'm like, but I don't have that many new jokes, so I did kind of the same thing. I'm like, well, I need new material. I need, it's been a year. I should have 8 minutes of new material.
Yeah.
I think I probably only put in about 4 minutes of new material. It's all right.
So, take out comedy. You're doing that health once a week?
Twice take a out week? Now?
No, but then.
Like oh, then. Then, yeah, at least once a week. Yeah. Sometimes twice.
Yeah.
Jamie was really nice to me. He would basically let me do it as much as I wanted, which is a great thing. Comedians don't usually get that.
Yeah.
I started doing it only once a week because you start losing your entire social life.
Yeah.
If all you're doing is stand-up comedy every weekend night.
So what was the next thing along then? So you're doing stakeout comedy twice a week.
It's called stakeout comedy?
You're doing takeout comedy once or twice a week for a few years.
Yeah.
Was there anything else happening? Were there any other shows you were getting involved in?
Well, we were trying to sort of outsource comedy a bit. Jamie would. Do you remember? So Jamie, in the early days, we used to do lots of shows around Hong Kong because he was trying everything.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, he was trying everything to like just get comedy out there because nobody had ever heard of comedy in Hong Kong except for the Punchline, but that was just once a month. International people coming in.
Inside the stuff again.
Oh, sorry.
Punchline Comedy Club.
Yeah.
It's in quite a few different countries. They bring in three comedians from normally. Yeah. They bring in three comedians from overseas.
Yeah.
And they stay for a weekend doing lots of shows.
Yeah, and they were pros, and they had a marketing team, and so they people knew about them. But I remember Jamie trying to do shows out in Kowloon. We'd be doing it in bizarre little restaurants in the middle of Kowloon.
Yes.
Wait, were you at that one? Oh, there was one.
One in Kun Tong.
Yes, that's what I'm thinking of. That one in Kun Tong.
So
that was the weirdest one we did. It wasn't that the bar was weird or anything. It was that we were in the middle of an industrial zone.
Yeah.
At a restaurant that just didn't fit into the area at all. We were standing on a stage with like a Chinese silk screen behind us. That show went okay though. The show went all right.
It was all right.
Yeah, but it was just such a weird area to be doing a show in. And then we used to do shows in Chim Sat Choi all the time.
Yeah, lots of those. Yeah.
Angelo's shows. Yeah, so that kind of stuff. We did a couple times, sort of the renegade comedians did their own shows.
Mm. And then Jamie would get angry with you.
Yeah, that is correct. Then Jamie would get a little angry, and a couple of people stopped. There were some friendships were lost.
That's right.
Some friendships were lost.
Yeah, they were.
Now,
are there any key turning points or phases in the stand-up comedy for you since you started about 13 years ago in Hong Kong?
Well, let me think. There has been one recently. But I'm trying to think if there was anything before that. No. So for the very first like 6 or 7 years, for me, my sort of growth in this was very slow and steady. But yeah. like that's it. So I got better because of stage time.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say my material got, you know, amazing. I couldn't find my voice for the longest time.
Really?
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like I think comedians, yeah. one of the hardest things to do in the beginning is figure out who you are as a comedian.
Yeah.
What your voice is up there.
Yeah.
And I don't mean anything deep like what message am I trying to portray.
Well, I thought you found it quite early on. This guy's Ryan. That's Ryan, I can tell.
Oh, thanks.
But when did you think you found it? What was the moment?
So I mean Yeah, the reason why I say this, just to backtrack a little bit, is because I definitely watched some of my tapes and noticed that my voice would change. Literally, my voice would change. Like after Paul Ogata, who's a really good and how would I describe Paul? Paul's like almost an in-house comedian in Hong Kong.
Yeah,
he's been here so many times.
Yeah.
He's from the United States. This I'm just doing the insider information
That's
stuff.
Very good.
But Paul Ogata, you know, I noticed after like he would come through, I'd start talking a little bit more like Paul Ogata. And then,
yeah.
but the one that I really noticed is, do you remember Ted Alexandro or Alexandro? Alexander? Alexandro.
I remember the name.
Ted Alexandro is a really, is a fairly well-known comedian in America, especially on the East Coast, New York. Very good comedian. But he's got this really laid-back, you know, like he just goes back, he reaches, grabs the curtain, he's kind of like just, he's like talking to you, but he's like almost, he just sounds like he's so calm up there on stage. And then I watch my tapes after that, and here I'm doing like Ryan Honeck, like, yeah, I'm so cool, collected up on stage. I absolutely saw myself copying these people. And that, so I realized that was just me trying to find out which one fit me the best.
Yeah.
But the big thing happened for me, and I do give Jamie a lot of credit for this. Jamie was pushing me to host shows a lot, and I didn't want to, because hosting shows is a different thing.
Yeah.
You have to use a different power, right?
Yeah.
Because you really shouldn't just be doing material when you host.
No.
You should be engaging the audience.
Yeah.
But when you engage the audience, you don't know what they're going to say.
Yeah.
So trying to, like, the pressure of you engaging the audience and then actually saying something funny in response.
I know. How are you going to think up something funny on the spot?
Exactly. So for the longest time, I didn't want to do it. Because I thought, how am I ever going to get to the point where I can ask them a question? Like, hey, where are you from? Germany. Okay, good. Good, okay. Where are you from? France. All right, France. Good,
yes.
good. And where were you from? Spain. Okay. All right, good. That's what I was so afraid was going to happen.
Do you want to hear my hosting? This was my hosting.
Oh, I remember your hosting.
My hosting would be, that was Ryan Honeck. Big guy, big guy. Next up is Paul Ogata.
Hey, do you remember one time I actually told you, I go, Ben, I like when you host because you have everything, you do everything that you need to do up there. You were high energy and you kept the show going.
But I didn't. I was off the stage as quick as possible because I didn't want to talk to the audience. I hadn't got that skill.
Fair enough. But in the very beginning, you would always start off with comedy.
Yeah.
Get the audience warmed up.
Yeah.
You got them energized. I liked when you hosted. Especially, let's put it this way, especially at a time when we did not have good hosts.
Yeah, I guess so.
I don't want to call out anyone on that. But you know, like...
No, we were still learning.
Everyone was learning.
Yeah,
everyone
so
was learning.
My way of learning was not to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It was just to be really quickly on and off. Just bang, bang, bang.
Yep. Well, it is still the benefit of hosting, is you can do that.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I started hosting, and at first it was hosting with just like I would tell my jokes, and then I'd try to talk a little out to the audience a little bit, and then quickly go back to my jokes.
Yeah.
And now, for better or for worse, that has become my voice, my style, is when I'm on stage. Now it is I love engaging the audience and then bringing it back to my material. So even when I'm not hosting, when I'm just doing a long set, I do a lot of audience work. And, you know, I did a show just last Friday, and it was so fun because after the show, I sat down with these three, like, 20-something-year-old kids.
Yeah.
I think they've been to comedy shows in New York.
Yeah.
But they were like, how did you do that? You were talking to the audience, and then you made up these jokes on the spot about what they said. How, like, we couldn't believe it. And that wasn't it. That was an illusion. Like, I was like, oh, you're from the Philippines? I have a joke about the Philippines. I'm gonna connect it to you being from the Philippines. Oh, you're a teacher? I got a joke about being a teacher. So, and then, but to those kids, they thought that I was just making up these jokes on the spot.
And tell me about corporate shows.
corporate comedy is very different than what we normally are doing on stage.
Yeah.
Corporate comedy, whenever I do a corporate show, and I've done a few, I really, I'll be honest with you, and I think most comedians say the same thing, corporate shows suck. because you're, you like, the audience, they're adults. They want to laugh. Yeah. But they all also know that they're sitting in a corporate environment, so they can't laugh at the things that would really make them laugh normally.
Yeah.
So and then the comedians are handcuffed because they're told ahead of time, nothing about this, nothing about this, you know, no political jokes, no foul language, no sex jokes. And they're like, well, you've just thrown out like 90% of my act, so I guess we're going to hear about my mom and their towels now, you know.
How do you come up with new material? As it's a hobby, you just spend your whole life, your spare time, writing things down.
I absolutely do not do any of that, and I should. But, you know, I'll tell you this. This is my method.
Okay.
What I do now is I do, if anything, if I find something kind of funny, I write down the note in my phone. I write the note down on my phone. But I never write the joke out.
Right.
Because I'm just too lazy. I don't feel motivated to write comedy unless I've got a show that night.
Right.
Like, some people can sit on a Sunday afternoon, write comedy, and know that they're not going to perform it for a week. To me, no, I can't get motivated. I can't do that. So for me, it is literally, this is a weird thing, I take a shower before the show. In the shower, I write my jokes.
Really?
Yeah. Like
that late?
Yeah, exactly. Before the show, that's where I'm going over every new bit I've ever done was done in the shower just before the show.
And you come up with a joke in the shower?
The joke I probably came up with earlier, you know what I mean?
Got like, notes,
yeah. But I do it in the shower.
Yeah.
I tell it maybe five, six, seven, eight times until I get the words down.
Yeah.
It's a long shower. It's a very long shower, Ben. I waste a lot of water. But it is where I do my thinking for the shows. And it's always the night of the show. It never is anything other day. Because I just don't feel motivated.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because you do it the night of the show. So you do it, and then an hour or two later, a couple hours later, you're actually doing on stage.
Exactly. And there is that sort of, you've got that excitement.
Yeah.
You know, like, you've got the motivation to get it, you know?
Mm.
So that's it.
Any tips for someone who's starting out at stand-up comedy?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, beyond just the basic try it, the one thing I would say is, all right, let me tell you this by telling you a story.
That can also help me, because I tried it for 10 years, and if you ask me why I stopped, the answer was, apart from the fact that I wasn't any good.
Oh, that's not fair.
I was quite good. I was actually quite good at not showing people that I wasn't that good. Because my act, if people won't know, was basically putting a condom on my head, jumping around, making silly comments, and blowing the condom up.
Yeah.
And that was my act. So I was a novelty act. I was a sort of a one-trick pony. And to my credit, in the later stages of my stand-up comedy career, I did stop going to takeout so much. I went more to open mics to try and write some written material.
Okay.
But I could never really
get it. Wasn't
it
happening?
Get it to work.
I remember you going to the open mics.
And then open mics, because my written material wasn't working, new jokes, I went back to doing the condom with the open mic, and that's when I thought, okay, I think it's time to take a big break.
but you know that the great thing is that you are forever known as the guy who puts a condom on his head.
No, as a marketing device, it's pretty good.
You literally started every show with a bang. Like, it literally started the show with a bang, and it was a great, I mean, the audience.
Oh, this is great. He's talking about me.
Yeah, but the audience. Yeah, well, and the audience loved it because it got them excited. Got them excited. So there.
I did have actually. When I say I wasn't good, I wasn't necessarily that good at the classic stand up comedy of being there with no props, telling jokes. But I did have certain strengths, and one of my strengths was, whereas other comedians might find it quite. Might not want to go on first. I loved going on first because I could get home to my kids again really quickly.
Yeah.
And because I had an act which would basically, if the audience was cold and not quite ready, it made my act even weirder. Some guy jumping around with a condom on his head, and that made it even better. So it didn't really matter.
That was the thing I always liked about you going first, was that I would agree with you in the sense that maybe some of the stuff you're doing was not. You did have jokes. You did.
I had some jokes.
Yeah.
Most of my best jokes were sort of cobbled together from other ideas I'd seen on TV or something.
Yeah.
Most of my original jokes, I think, weren't subtle enough. They're too obvious, my punchlines.
I think you're not giving yourself enough credit, because the jokes were fine, and obvious was needed in the early days of Hong Kong comedy, because your audiences didn't all speak English, so obvious was good. But no, what I would say is, the one thing is, you started every show, not to get too far off track, but you started every show, they were excited. So, in a way, your clowning abilities...
Yeah, I used the things that I knew.
Yes. And so, you know, in a way, for a comedian that was following you, it was a great thing. Because we knew that they were awake and they were paying attention. Mm-hmm. That was good.
But if I went on in the middle of the show, it was harder for me. Unless the person before me had done really badly.
Yeah.
If the person before me had done really badly... I loved it.
You know, that's the thing. So, yeah, you had a certain set of skills. You had a certain set of skills. And, when applied correctly, they were very good.
Yeah.
Was there any... Oh, but tips. Tips. Oh, sorry. Yeah, you were asking about tips. Yeah. Yes. So getting back to that. I'll just tell you the story very quickly.
Talking about me isn't a tip. You shouldn't necessarily do what I do. I've also got tinnitus in my ear, which may well be from blowing up condoms.
I would not be surprised. So my tip for anyone who wants to get started is the generic advice of just get up and do it. And here's the reason I said that. I had a friend of mine in university, and he and I both wanted to do stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
And I started doing it, and I, you know, here in Hong Kong, and I went back to Chicago, and I called him. I'm like, hey, I'm doing an open mic in Chicago. You should come. And he's like, oh, yeah. He's like, yeah, I'm going to get some stuff together, too. And I'm like, oh, good, good. He's like, I've never done it before. I'll try. I'm like, good. Well, I went there. He never showed up. He later told me, he's like, well, you know what I decided I'm going to do? I'm going to put together my first 30 minutes of comedy.
Wow.
I'm going to put it on a DVD. I'm going to send it all around to all the different comedy clubs, and I'm going to see if I can get some time that way, because I don't want to just get up there and do five.
Right.
That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. That was
no offense to your friend.
No offense to my friend. Oh, he's an idiot. Because, like, I try to explain it to him. I'm like, man, that's not how it works at all. Never going to happen.
You're saying you've got to go out there and just practice.
Absolutely. Because there is such a difference between what you have on paper, what you hear in your mind, and what comes out of those speakers when you talk into a microphone.
Probably the only tool, the only prop you have on stage is the microphone and the microphone stand. Do you have any favorite kinds of microphone stands or microphones? Do you prefer cordless? Do you prefer wires?
Don't ever freaking give me a wireless mic. I think every comedian agrees wireless mics are the bane of stand-up comedy.
Now why is that, Ryan?
Oh, my God. I mean, I've had it happen before where the wireless mic, first of all, if it cuts out, that's the worst. But they don't. It's not even that. It's not even like full... you know, breakdown that you're worried about. It's that every once in a while they drop. Every once in a while. So you know, and it's happened more than once where I'll be telling a joke and then drops right at the punchline. There's a recording of it.
Just
in fact, during one of my one of the competitions, I was doing a joke, and the one word that is the big like punchline of that joke, the mic just for a second just popped
that's
off.
Interesting, yeah. Because I guess I haven't really thought about this. So the wire, the mic with the wire, isn't going to cut out as fast. It's getting power all the time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So wireless mics are the bane of my existence. I hate them.
How to deal with an audience when no one seems to be watching or listening?
Two ways. One is now that I host, I try to directly get their attention, meaning focused to individual audience members.
Yeah.
Grab their attention. The second thing is just do your stuff and get off stage.
Yeah.
As quickly as possible.
Yes, fulfill your contractual obligations.
Yeah.
Can I personally and go off.
Yeah, because this can I tell you like an example of
go
this?
For it.
So I was doing a show. It was an awful, awful show at a bar. It was a mixer event, and the guy running it was like, we just want you to get up there and do like 5 minutes of comedy. It's going to be great. I'm like, all right. I'm like, but are you going to set it up? Are you going to let them know? He's like, yeah. He's like, I'll get their attention. I'll make sure everyone knows comedy's going on. Make sure the music's down. So I'm like, okay, all right, I'll do this. So he gets up. There's like, everyone's talking. Nobody's paying attention. Everyone's mixing and mingling. The music's on, lights on. I go, like, he goes on stage. He's like, all right, everybody, Ryan Honeck, stand-up comedy. That's it.
Nobody even heard him. They haven't stopped. So now I go up there, and this is only a year ago. Yo. So like I've done this for a while.
Yeah.
So I'm up there, and now I'm engaging the first people that are near me, like five people that are near me.
Yeah.
So I get their attention. I'm talking to them. I'm doing the best I can. It's five minutes. I don't care. But it's going okay with these five people.
Yeah.
Get off stage, whatever. So I'm walking home from the show afterwards, and this girl comes up to me at 7-Eleven, and she goes, she's like, oh, you were the one doing that stand-up comedy thing. I'm like, yeah. She's like, yeah, I hope that, like, you can practice and get a little bit better at that, but don't give up. This is the worst part, because you know, it wasn't me that was bad, it was the environment, but from an audience's perspective, they don't know that.
This guy's not good, is what they think.
They just think I'm not good.
How would you describe the market in Hong Kong? And this is something we just mentioned briefly, in passing. That's the word I was looking for.
Yeah.
So, Takeout Comedy Club began in Hong Kong in 2007.
Yeah.
And it went for quite a long time, but after about 10 years, the audiences were dropping.
They were.
But it seems to have revived again.
You know what I think it really is, though, Ben? I think it's marketing. You know, Jamie did some amazing things getting that club going.
I know.
Taking it from nothing to what he took it to, and keeping it going for 10 years, and now going still.
Yeah.
But, you can't be everything.
No.
The new club that's come in has a marketing team.
Right.
So, like, the last five shows sold out.
Yeah, fair is fair, because Jamie was just one guy.
Exactly.
Yeah, and he started from nothing, so hats off to him.
Absolutely.
We wouldn't be here if it hadn't been for him.
Yeah, I mean, let's be honest. Like, the new club that's come into town, The Riff, which is a great place, but they had the advantage of coming here with an established scene.
Yeah.
So they didn't have to do that, and they know that. They're okay with that. Where Jamie came here with literally nothing.
Pretty amazing that he changed anything.
Yeah, and turned into that.
How about bad venues? Have you had venues where there's columns in the way of the stage, so the audience can't see you, or you had super low ceiling, or you can't even stand up, or anything really terrible venue?
Yes, 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 and all of those, yes. The worst venue that I've ever done a show at, we did a show in Shenzhen, and right in front of the stage was a pool table. Which, thankfully, they closed during the show, but it was the entire front section was the pool table, so nobody was near the stage at all. Yeah, that was bad. Columns. Low ceilings.
Yeah.
Oh, no microphones, no lights sometimes. I mean, come on. I will tell you, I remember, this was actually the worst show setup we had. Now that you said that, I remember.
Yeah.
We did a show in the Philippines in Cebu,
and
it was at a hotel, and in front of the hotel was like a hot tub.
Okay.
In front of the stage was a hot tub.
Yeah, yeah.
And beyond that was just like people sitting. The only thing was this hotel, it was a bad show. It catered to Koreans. So everyone in the audience was Korean. None of them spoke English. So we had this idea. We did the show. We're like, oh, because we thought we were gonna kill. We didn't know that the audience was gonna be Korean. And we're like, we had this whole idea that comedians are gonna, we were gonna kill. And you know that feeling? You were just talking about that feeling when you finish a show and you feel like you're on top of the world.
Yeah.
We're like, we're just gonna dive right into the hot tub and be like, woo! Instead, the reality was that show went so badly that all of us just like quietly, you know, cowered away from the show.
Yeah. For people who want to find out more about you, where can they find you online?
Yeah. Okay, so I have a website. It's Ryan Hynek, RyanHynek.com, or on Instagram, Ryan Hynek. Yeah, Ryan Hynek. It was a comedy competition. And here's the thing. I've been in all these comedy competitions at Takeout for years. And what always happened was, in the preliminary round, I'd have a great set, and then in the finals, it just wouldn't gel the same way it did in the prelims, right? This year it was gelling. Like, I was killing up there on stage.
Yeah.
And what you have to know about the finals is you're given a little bit more time in the finals than in the preliminaries.
Yeah.
So I knew I had a little more time. I'm just up there. I've killed it for like 7 minutes. I'm wrapping it up. I'm just about to tell my last punchline. Microphone cuts.
Because there was an initial time limit.
Well, I was going to say, so microphone cuts, here's the thing. I know that I got to watch. I know I got more time.
Oh.
So I keep going. I'm shouting my punchline out loud to the audience now with the mic off. And then the MC running the show comes up, pulls me off stage.
Oh.
Yeah. And then he gets up there and tries to, like,
he's there, I remember.
Yeah, yeah, he tries to make, you know, he tries to make a joke about what happened, because nobody knows that what happened was the guy running the sound cut me off 1 full minute early by accident, because he didn't know that we had longer time in the in the finals. Actually, Ben, that was your fault. You went before, didn't you go before me?
That was my fault.
You went right before me. You were on stage right before me, and you went short. So that's why we didn't discover the error until I went right after you. That's right. You were involved in that story.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So
must have been the only year I have ever made it to the finals. That's a terrible but amazing story to end with.
Yeah, yeah. Right? Hey, Ben, thanks a lot for having me on the show.
Pleasure.
You have to trust me that these are, this is real. This is, okay, I'm so, Mom, I'm sorry. Hold on, wait. Wait. I gotta warm up.
Whoa!
Okay, now.
And that was still just one armpit.
That was just one armpit. Wow. Now, Ben, that was legitimately from an armpit. I have made people vomit thinking that that was real. Camping trips where I would do that, like in the tent, everyone thinking it was 100% real. Yeah, that is my hidden talent that I don't get to share very often.
This was Meet the Entertainers, and I am Big Ben. Each episode takes a surprisingly large number of hours to prepare, record, and edit, and check, and re-edit, and re-record, and edit again, and throw in the bin, and mend my computer, and take it out of the bin, and redo it from scratch, and then post it again. So, if you're getting something out of this series, here are three things you can do. Number one,
you can financially support this podcast by going to www.thebigbenshow.com/podcasts and making a financial donation of any amount you like.
Number two, subscribe or share these podcasts or give me a good review on iTunes. And thirdly, get in touch. I'm always looking for more people to interview. My email is ben@thebigbenshow.com. Many thanks. Talk to you again soon.